It is Louise Glick. She's Poet Laureate at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. The Wild Iris won the Pulitzer in 92. Shall we launch that?
Sure.
It'd be good to set that up. It's been called one long poem by some people, but I'm not sure I go along with that.
Well, I think I meant it to be read as a single entity.
As a single sitting. Right?
Yeah.
Didn't you even say that once?
Well, that I say that repeatedly.
Yeah.
This is giving the lie to my idea that I don't want to tell people how to read my books. But, in fact, I do. The books since Ararat, The Wild Iris, Meadowlands, Vita Nova, and the new one, all of them, I think, in different ways are holes. I always worked very hard on organizing groups of disparate lyrics into a shape that would give some indication of a larger ambition than might otherwise be apparent. And then after Ararat, I started writing these book-length sequences. Well, at least that's how they appeared to me. The Wild Iris takes its form from the arc of a summer in a garden. There are three types of speakers. The natural world speaks, and the poems spoken by the earth have the names of flowers, the silver lily, the wild iris, field flowers. Then there are poems in which a human speaker addresses occasionally the earth, I think, but mostly whatever, I have no word to describe this, divinity or celestial presence has animated its life.
People call it God.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Well, I don't. But it's shorthand. It's shorthand for whatever is not included in the human and the natural. Something is left out. And then there is the voice in which that presence responds, usually with impatient disappointment to the human being, occasionally with tenderness, exhausted tenderness. It became clear to me at a certain point that the sound of that voice was very like the sound of my mother, not in its elevations, but in its substance. I should also say that my mother was a great partisan, even very early, of my work and gave me great encouragement, but she also set a very high standard. And the book is shaped by the failure of these voices always to meet, the natural, which addresses the human that addresses the natural, and the divine that looks at it all and says, I had better hopes for you than this.
Life with conditions.
And this is the silver lily. It's toward the end of the book. If you are gardeners, you know that this comes, the lilies usually, not the day lilies, but the Asiatics and so on, bloom toward the end of summer. And in Vermont, where this garden was, the very end of summer. And oftentimes they don't even get to bloom because the snow falls first. The silver lily. The nights have grown cool again, like the nights of early spring, and quiet again. Will speech disturb you? We're alone now. We have no reason for silence. Can you see over the garden? The full moon rises. I won't see the next full moon. In spring, when the moon rose, it meant time was endless. Snowdrops opened and closed. The clustered seeds of the maples fell in pale drifts. White over white, the moon rose over the birch tree. And in the crook where the tree divides, leaves of the first daffodils in moonlight, soft greenish silver. We have come too far together toward the end now to fear the end. These nights, I am no longer even certain I know what the end means. And you, who've been with a man, after the first cries, doesn't joy, like fear, make no sound?
You have a title which says, it's either a remark or a title, I get them mixed up, Art in Service of Spirit. Whether you like to think it or not, you are one of our leading spiritual forces in poetry. And I don't know if that makes you uncomfortable. First of all, you ask the question, or the poems ask the question, do we need a creator? The poems needed a creator. So is that the answer?
I don't know the answer.
Oh, you just ask the questions, and we'll ponder them then. It is spiritual work, and everything you say about decay and growth, and I have a quote from another source. Well, actually, it's from Wild Iris. Then white light no longer disguised as matter, which sums up quite a bit of what you write about. The moving through, the temporal to the eternal. And I'm sure it's another one of those things you surely wouldn't want to stop and think about, as you did. But the spiritual lessons there are very interesting and difficult questions that are raised. In Wild Iris, would it bother you if somebody read it and didn't know there were three different persona there, that God was not an element, if they just read them as poems without those three?
I think they would be very confused. I don't know how they would manage to negotiate the book, but
I tried it both ways, as a matter of fact.
Did you?
And the poems work both ways.
Well, good.
Much richer as designed, but as poems, single poems, without the subtext, they live. Which I thought was very interesting. It was just an experiment I did.
Yeah.
And I did read where you were compared with George Herbert and Dickinson for their attachment to flowers, which I thought was just something to say. You know, critics will say anything. I've written reviews, and you can say anything you want. You can twist anything to work.
Yes, so I'm aware of that.
We'll just let that one say right where it is, okay? Wild Iris is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. If you do not own it now, you had just better get it, because it's a milestone in American letters. And we are here with Louise Glick. I am Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. Here's another quote from you. How do you like, "This is your life," Louise Glick?
It's very eerie.
Yeah. When you read something worth remembering, you liberate a human voice. You release into the world again a companion spirit. That's from Death and Absence, which you wrote. Very nice idea that the reader's important, too.
Well, I think that was my experience early on as a reader. I was a lonely child. My interactions with the world as a social being were unnatural, forced performances. And I was happiest reading. Well, it wasn't all that sublime. I watched a lot of television and ate a lot of food, too. But when I read, I felt that, especially when I read poems, I felt that the voices on the page, Blake and Eliot and Yeats, were my companions. I felt they were my, not just my teachers, I felt these are the people I would be able to talk to. they're talking to me. And my early writing was an attempt at communication with them, response to them. I think that most
That's
writers
nice.
Feel
yeah.
some sense of that dialogue with the dead. And when people ask, well, what do you want? What kind of response do you want to your work? What I want is for Blake to come down from heaven and say, Louise, you did a very good job. That's what I want. And fortunately, I have Blake surrogates who are alive, and their fastidious attention helps me, proves that effort is not wasted, that there are ears that receive. And you want to be such an ear yourself. I think that it's not possible to be a writer without being that kind of instrument for other people.
Consciousness attracts like consciousness, and you want to be in the company of those people who you understand and who understand you. That is just logical.
Yeah.
Even if you're a car mechanic, right?
And who hold you to a high standard.
Which apparently your friends do. They give you assignments.
Yeah, they do.
That's good. Louise Glick, Poet Laureate, on The Poet and the Poem. And we're going to go forward with more poetry. Should we hear another new one, or shall we give everyone a taste of the past publications?
This is Ararat, which is the first book that I did that I saw as a whole. And when I began writing it, it was clear to me that either it was going to be a book-length mosaic or it was a failure. The first poems were little poems about my father's death and suburban Long Island. I had struggled for a long time to discover a tone of voice that was colloquial. I seemed to have no gift for it. My earlier work is filled with Delphic distances, and it's not to say that these are not worth something, but it was very plain to me after four books that the way in which I spoke was never present in the way in which I wrote, and it troubled me that I had no access to that other voice. I could imitate other people's vernacular. I could do an imitation of William Carlos Williams, but that's what it was. It was a literary act. And finally, in Ararat, I learned how to do it. The book was overall deeply disliked, though I'm still very attached to it. It's one of my favorites of my books. But the poems are almost without figure, without beauty, without metaphor. I'll read a very long one and then perhaps a short one. Celestial Music. I have a friend who still believes in heaven. Not a stupid person, yet with all she knows, she literally talks to God. She thinks someone listens in heaven. On earth, she's unusually competent. Brave, too, able to face unpleasantness. We found a caterpillar dying in the dirt, greedy ants crawling over it. I'm always moved by weakness, by disaster, always eager to oppose fatality, but timid also, quick to shut my eyes. Whereas my friend was able to watch, to let events play out according to nature. For my sake, she intervened, brushing a few ants off the torn thing and set it down across the road. My friend says, I shut my eyes to God, that nothing else explains my aversion to reality. She says, I'm like the child who buries her head in the pillow so as not to see. the child who tells herself that light causes sadness. My friend is like the mother, patient, urging me to wake up an adult like herself, a courageous person. In my dreams, my friend reproaches me. We're walking on the same road, except it's winter now. She's telling me that when you love the world, you hear celestial music. Look up, she says. When I look up, nothing. Only clouds, snow, a white business in the trees like brides leaping to a great height. Then I'm afraid for her. I see her caught in a net deliberately cast over the earth. In reality, we sit by the side of the road watching the sunset, from time to time the silence pierced by a bird call. It's this moment we're both trying to explain, the fact that we're at ease with death, with solitude. My friend draws a circle in the dirt. Inside, the caterpillar doesn't move. She's always trying to make something whole, something beautiful, an image capable of life apart from her. We're very quiet. It's peaceful sitting here, not speaking. The composition fixed, the road turning suddenly dark, the air going cool, here and there the rocks shining and glittering. It's this stillness that we both love. The love of form is a love of endings.
The voice of Louise Glick. Did you want to read another from that book?
Yeah, I'll read the last poem, which is very short. First memory. Long ago, I was wounded. I lived to revenge myself against my father, not for what he was, for what I was. From the beginning of time, in childhood, I thought that pain meant I was not loved. It meant I loved.
That is a fabulous book, Ararat.
I like Ararat, too.
On impoverishment, you speak, and you talk about the terror of losing yearning and how when you plug in, I'm paraphrasing this, you plug into a deeper source, which where your recurring themes of eternal themes, where you can plug into that, and that can renew, and you find your force in that. So the yearning is the hydraulic system under your work, the yearning to write even one poem. You say, what do I wish for? I wish for another poem.
Yep.
And that's it, isn't it?
It sure is.
And when that goes away, yipes, we are cold and naked when that goes away. But surely, having accomplished this pile of books, you know that it will come back.
Nope.
Yeah, that's what Maya Angelou says. Every time she sits down, she says, I do not know how to do this thing.
Well, in fact, you don't, because you don't want to do anything you've already done, and you are not any longer the person who wrote those books. I look at those poems or read them, and I think, how odd that I wrote them. I have no sense of having done so.
Alice Walker said when she finished The Color Purple that she didn't recognize. The characters just walked through her and walked away. She never realized she did it.
Yeah.
And this is so true. I would love another poem. When you look at something you wrote a long time ago, is there ever a sense of embarrassment because you're not there now?
Yes. There's poems I don't like anymore. That's different. My first book, I feel firstborn, embarrassed by, though I was enormously proud of it at the time. I thought it was just perfectly great. Now I look at it and I think it's thin and unformed and filled with the wish, animated by the wish to write. It took me about 6 years to write the following book, The House on Marshland. And I think that from that point on, I'm willing to sign my name. This is a poem called For Jane Myers, who was a early friend in Plainfield, Vermont, my son's godmother. Sap rises from the sodden ditch and glues two green ears to the dead birch twig. Perilous beauty. And already Jane is digging out her colored tennis shoes, one mauve, one yellow, like large crocuses. And by the laundromat, the Bartletts in their tidy yard, as though it were not wearying, to hear in the bushes the mild harping of the breeze, the daffodils flocking and honking. Look how the bluet falls apart, mud pockets the seed. Months, years, then the dull blade of the wind. It is spring, we are going to die. And now April raises up her plaque of flowers, and the heart expands to admit its adversary.
Would you be surprised if some people like that book better than any other?
No, because they've told me so. Mm-hmm. I wish they wouldn't, but they do.
What does that mean? It means that it reverberates differently for everyone.
Oh, I think it means that this book is, it's impeccably pretty. It's, everything in it is artful, compact, delicate. There's none of the assonance that Ararat is made of. It's not my favorite, but it's one of my most likable,
people like
crowd-pleasing books.
The truth to be pretty. They like the truth to be pretty. But I think there's some strong stuff in there.
Oh, I think it's a good book.
Yeah.
I think it's a good book. I'm glad it's not the book I have.
The last book you wrote.
Yes, I'm glad of that.
We are at the Library of Congress, and we are celebrating the new poet laureate, Louise Glick. This is a repository for the world's treasures, as you know. We will be reading a final poem.
I'll read the title poem called Descending Figure, which is a poem in three separate sections, each of which has its own title. And I think you can begin to see in this book what emerged in Ararat as the book-length sequence. The lyric impulse that was no longer, as it had been, contained in the single poem, but began to contrive for itself debates or patterns. This is a poem about a lost child, a child who died. Descending figure, the wanderer. At twilight, I went into the street. The sun hung low in the iron sky, ringed with cold plumage. If I could write to you about this emptiness. Along the curb, groups of children were playing in the dry leaves. Long ago, at this hour, my mother stood at the lawn's edge, holding my little sister. Everyone was gone. I was playing in the dark street with my other sister, whom death had made so lonely. Night after night, we watched the screened porch filling with a gold magnetic light. Why was she never called? Often I would let my own name glide past me, though I craved its protection. The sick child. A small child is ill, has wakened. It is winter, past midnight in Antwerp. above a wooden chest, the stars shine, and the child relaxes in her mother's arms. The mother does not sleep. She stares fixedly into the bright museum. By spring, the child will die. Then it is wrong, wrong to hold her. Let her be alone, without memory, as the others wake, terrified, scraping the dark paint from their faces. For my sister. Far away, my sister is moving in her crib. The dead ones are like that, always the last to quiet. Because however long they lie in the earth, they will not learn to speak, but remain uncertainly pressing against the wooden bars, so small the leaves hold them down. Now, if she had a voice, the cries of hunger would be beginning. I should go to her. Perhaps if I sang very softly, her skin so white, her head covered with black feathers.
The voice of Louise Glick. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. This program is made possible by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Our engineer is Brad McCoy. Associate producer is Mike Turpin of MET Studios. I'm Grace Cavalieri.